Hitler's War by David Irving. Part 2, Toward the Promised Land. In Hitler's Chancellery. When Hitler had returned to Berlin on January 8, 1939, Spears's new Reich Chancellery was complete. The long frontage of yellow stucco and gray stone dominated a quarter-mile stretch of Vossstrasse. Dwarfed by its tall square columns, the motionless gray-uniformed sentries melted into the buildings, invisible until they presented arms to passing officers. The 400 rooms housed the civil service and the party's organization. To the left were the offices of Hans Lammers, to the right, Otto Meissner's presidential chancellery. On the top floor was Philipp Buller's chancellery of the Führer of the Nazi Party. Everywhere, yellow signs pointed to air raid shelters. Little trace of Hitler's chancellery now remains, except the occasional red marble planter or tabletop anonymously gracing the home of a former general or member of his staff. The staterooms were on the ground floor. Visitors arrived by limousine at the reception area and were conducted through a flight of halls of ascending grandeur until the Führer's study itself was reached, a large room with ponderous chandeliers and an immense pastel-colored carpet. Three heads adorned the front panels of his great desk. One of them was Medusa, complete with writhing snakes emerging from her hair. Yet Hitler himself was rarely seen in the new chancellery. He continued to live and work in the old building, which survived at right angles to Spears's new structure. Here, in the first floor of the old chancellery, he had his residence. In an entrance hall and quote-unquote garden room, with four more rooms opened onto an old garden of almost monastic solitude. Here was his equestrian statue of Frederick the Great, given to him by François Poncet, and the Lenbach portrait of Bismarck. In this building, too, was Hitler's real study. Its walls were hung with wallpaper of heavy red velour. A sturdy suite of chairs by Troost had replaced the fragile Louis XIV furniture after a misfortune with a bulky Indian Maharaja 4 years before. On January 12, 1939, an episode of some significance occurred in Spears's new building during the New Year diplomatic reception, which, with Goering's birthday celebration, opened the year for Berlin officialdom. Wearing his brown party tunic, Hitler awaited in his cabinet room. He could hear the diplomats arriving, the drill of the guard of honor and the familiar sounds of protocol. He had begun to relish this foppery. In July 1938, he had instructed that the Egyptian minister was to be received with a full guard of honor, while the Soviet ambassador was to be accorded no honors at all, as befitted the pariah that he was. At noon, Hitler now walked through to the great reception hall, where the diplomats had drawn up in a self-conscious semicircle and stationed himself beneath the two crystal chandeliers so that he could read his speech without spectacles. He briefly shook hands with each diplomat in turn, but when he reached the Russian, Alexei Merikalov, he paused and began a conversation. In the jealous diplomatic world, the content was unimportant. It was time elapsed that mattered. Hitler talked to Merikalov for several minutes. In this way, he hinted to Moscow that he could easily let bygones be bygones. Hitler would brag to his generals on August 22nd, on the eve of his historical deal with Stalin, that he had begun working for it at this very reception. For two decades, Russo-German relations had been marked by a mutual distrust. The cautious cooperation launched in 1922 at Rapallo had survived until 1933. Germany had furnished special equipment and know-how. Russia, raw materials and space for the clandestine training of the Reichswehr. The Reichswehr had supplied the Russians with German training manuals, weapon prototypes, and staff college training in Germany. The Nazi Revolution of 1933 had momentarily thwarted Moscow's aspirations in Germany. Adolf Hitler was, after all, the author of Mein Kampf, and Chapter 14 continued to appear unamended, laying bare his undimmed hatred of the Soviet Union and his aims for conquest there. Hitler quietly admired Stalin, how Bolshevism had subjected the Slav subhumans, as he called them, to the, quote, tyranny of a Jewish ruling clique, unquote, and established precisely the kind of elite leadership with which he was struggling to invest Germany. Each side continued, however, to prepare for war with the other. In March 1936, Hitler openly told the Reichstag about the unending fertile plains of the Ukraine, in which the Germans would one day, quote-unquote, wallow in plenty. In his 1938 secret speeches, he always referred to the Soviet Union's military power as a quantité negligible. But with the realization that Poland was unwilling to become an accessory, it dawned on Hitler that Stalin's aid might become useful. Since Munich, Hitler had cautiously stated his first demand on Poland, for the return of Danzig and overland access to East Prussia. But Poland had rebuffed him. Hitler could not shelve the Polish problem permanently. East Prussia was vital to his Ostpolitik, his future crusade in the East. Its capital, Königsberg, was German through and through. In its 14th century cathedral rested the bones of philosopher Immanuel Kant and many a Hohenzollern prince. But the province had an impoverished and declining population, a consequence he reflected on May 12, 1942, of earlier Prussian governments. Government's folly in regarding it as a penal colony for teachers, civil servants, and officers who had failed to make the grade at home. It is significant that Hitler tackled this deficit on February 1, 1939, with a secret decree on the, quote, reinforcement of the eastern borderlands, unquote, and with economic measures calculated to reverse the drain of manpower and capital from East Prussia. Meanwhile, he had long since sworn to recover Danzig, a, quote, northern Nuremberg, unquote, for Germany. He wore the Danzig emblem, a silver ship sailing on blue waves, engraved on his cufflinks. He had nurtured the hope since September 1938 that he could do a deal with Poland for the bloodless return of Danzig in exchange for the Carpatho-Ukraine coveted by Poland. Ribbentrop had aired this idea to the Polish ambassador Joseph Lipski on October 24th. Lipski had replied evasively. Undismayed, Hitler had invited the Polish foreign minister, Colonel Joseph Beck, to come in the new year. Their secret meeting took place at the Berghof on January 5, 1939. Beck refused to rise to his bait. This was why Hitler left for Berlin 2 days later, resolved to play for Stalin's hand instead. His protracted dalliance with Merikalov was the first move, a conspicuous abstinence from attacking the USSR in his anniversary speech on January 30th was the second. In Berlin, Hitler kept relatively regular hours, receiving individual cabinet ministers during the morning, then lunching as late as 3 or 4. He joked that his dining room ought to be called, quote, the cheerful chancellor's, unquote. Women were excluded. This lunch table assembly was, in fact, the closest that he came to holding a cabinet meeting after 1938, though once in February 1939 he did agree to Lammers's suggestion that one should be called, but Goering was away in Italy, recovering from a slimming cure, and the project was abandoned. Tott's diary shows he came 9 times, including once on January 27, 1939, to show Hitler the planning for the immense Hamburg suspension bridge. After lunch, Hitler read newspapers, bought by an aide each day from a kiosk at the nearby Kaiserhof Hotel. In earlier years, he had taken tea in the Kaiserhof. As he entered, the little orchestra would strike up the, quote, donkey serenade, unquote, his favorite Hollywood movie tune. He was, he confessed, a fan of Shirley Temple and Jeanette MacDonald. He saw whatever films he liked, but he kept up a running commentary of invective unless the movie found his favor right from the first reel. Quote, what filth is this? It should be suppressed, unquote. Quote, how can the doctor permit a film like this? Who directed it? End quote. The Führer's SS adjutants dutifully compiled a list of pithy one-line reviews and sent them to the propaganda ministry. His edicts had the weight of law, and woe betide a film that attracted the Führer's ultimate reproof, quote, broken off in mid-film, unquote. Prairie Hyenas, Tip Off Girls, King of Arizona, Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, The Great Gambini, Shanghai, all of these movies came to an unscripted end in Hitler's chancellery. When Marie Antoinette was shown, he got up and stalked out. He was uncertain over his next move. Quote, quote, perhaps, wrote Goebbels on February 1, 1939, it's the Czechs' turn again, unquote. Over lunch the next day, the minister observed Hitler thinking out loud. Quote, he is hatching new plans again, he recorded. A real Napoleon, end quote. On the 13th, Hitler's special train bore him toward Hamburg. There, the largest Nazi battleship, 35,000 armor-plated tons, was waiting to be launched. First, in quiet homage, he visited in nearby Friedrichsruh, the tomb of Bismarck, the statesman whose name he had selected for the Reich's first super warship. Next morning, as bands serenaded the 50,000 spectators, a green ferry called the Führer across the Elbe from the St. Pauli Pier to the Blom and Voss shipyard. In Hamburg, a public display had been declared. The bands fell silent as Hitler marched to the tall scaffold and delivered his set speech, praising his great predecessor's works in founding the Second Reich. Hitler had himself positioned every newsreel camera and forbidden foreign newspaper reporters to attend. After 10 minutes of his speech, a small red lamp glowed in his rostrum, warning that the last props were being hammered away and that the Colossus was about to move. The new battleship Bismarck rumbled down to the Elbe to the strains of the German national anthem. How revealing is Baron von Wiesacker's private note on the Führer's fireside remarks after an intimate meal at the Bismarck Shrine at Friedrichsruh on that day, February 13th. Quote, for those of us who know that the rest of Czechoslovakia will be dealt with... Sorry, let me start that over again. For those of us who know that the rest of Czechoslovakia will be dealt its death blow in approximately 4 weeks' time, it was interesting to hear the Führer declare that he himself used to prefer the surprise tactics, but he has now gone off them as he has exhausted their possibilities. The Führer sketched out the September crisis of last year thusly, quote, I owe my triumph to my unflinching stand, which left the other side with a whiff of war if I felt it necessary. End quote. The sequence for the likely invasion of Czechoslovakia had now evolved, and along with it, a formula to make it palatable to the Western powers. Wiesacker himself, in an undated note, described the likely scenario. An artificially induced squabble split Slovakia from the Prague government. Germany advises Hungary, quote, to restore order, unquote, in the Carpathia Ukraine. Slovak government asks Hitler to guarantee its frontiers. Germans in Bohemia appeal for protection. Ultimatum to Prague to sign treaty with the Reich, failing which the Wehrmacht will invade. Goebbels' propaganda machine puts the blame on the Czechs, stressing the moderation of the German action and listing similar episodes in history. Since Munich's agents had burrowed deep into Slovakia's structure, nameless agents of Himmler's SS, Goebbels' ministry, Goering's four-year plan office, and the Nazi foreign organization AO had fanned out across Slovakia. By January 21, 1939, when Hitler had a tough interview with the Czech foreign minister Tchaikovsky, it was obvious that his decision had been taken. He demanded absolute Czech neutrality and a considerable reduction in Czech forces. Tchaikovsky promised compliance. Wojtek Tuka, Slovak agitator who had suffered long years of Czech imprisonment and had only recently been amnestied after the flight of Beneš, telegraphed to Hitler a fulsome appeal to protect the Slovaks and accept them as the economic and cultural colleagues of the, quote, illustrious German nation, end quote. On about February 10th, Karmesin's men in Bratislava were confidentially tipped off that Hitler would topple the Prague regime in a month's time. Tuka visited Hitler on the 12th, formally placed the destiny of Slovakia in his hands. Quote, my people, he said, await their total liberation by you, End quote. Hitler dropped a series of powerful hints that Slovakia should declare her independence of Prague, the first stage in the scenario outlined, if not actually proposed, by Wiesacker. Wilhelm Kepler sent his close associate Dr. Edmund Wiesenmeyer to Bratislava to tell the Slovaks to hurry as, quote, otherwise Hungary will get our permission to occupy Slovakia at any time after March 15th, end quote. When Dukhansky and his economics minister visited Goering on February 28th, the field marshal greeted them with, quote, now what's it to be? When are you going to declare independence so we don't have to turn you over to the Hungarians, end quote. What happened on March 10th, 1939, found Hitler by no means unprepared. At 5:20 a.m., Walter Huell was telephoned from Vienna with the word that Czech troops had marched into Bratislava. Father Tiso, the Slovak prime minister, had taken refuge in a Jesuit college. Goebbels appreciated that this was the opportunity Hitler had been waiting for to, quote, solve the problem we left half-solved in October, end quote. Hitler sent for him at midday, then for other ministers. Hill's notes list conversations all morning between Ribbentrop, Heydrich, Schmundt, and Kepler. At 11:50 a.m., quote, Kepler telephones, Tuka arrested, telephones cut off, martial law, troops marching in, Karmesin may have been arrested too, end quote. At 11:55, quote, I go to the Führer, inform Schaub, end quote. At 12 noon, quote, phoned chief, that is Ribbentrop, is to come to Führer at once, end quote. Keitel was also sent for at 1 p.m. Hitler revealed that he had decided to march into the rest of Czechoslovakia on the 15th and seize Prague. Quote, our frontier must extend to the Carpathians, end quote, recorded Goebbels, and he remarked, quote, the Ides of March, end quote. Quote, we're all very pleased, Goebbels continued in his previously unpublished diary. Even Ribbentrop. The Führer shouts with joy. This is going to be a pushover. Late in the afternoon, over to the Führer again. We infer from one report that, before its arrest, the Tiso regime appealed in despair to the German government. The actual text can always be obtained later. The Führer says, and rightly so, that you can't make history with lawyers. You've got to have heart, head, and courage. Just what lawyers lack. In the evening, at my suggestion, the Führer visits the People's Theater to put up a facade. End quote. To dampen foreign press alarm, Nazi editors were secretly briefed that morning to devote no more than two columns to the Czech crisis. During the coming night, Hitler's SS Lifeguards Regiment, Liebstandarte, was alerted and issued with field-gray uniforms. In a secret speech to Staff College graduates on the 11th, Hitler explained, quote, the structure of a state demands that the Herrenvolk does the organizing, while a somewhat inferior mass of people, or let's call them an undominating kind of people, prostrate themselves to that leadership, end quote. History, ventured Hitler, afforded more than one example of a relatively thin stratum of dominators organizing a broad mass of slaves. For some days there was confusion in Czechoslovakia, quote, the attempt to whip things up with our SS has only partly succeeded, wrote Goebbels. It looks as if Slovakia is not playing along, end quote. He talked over tactics with Hitler on the 12th. They agreed to keep the crisis off the newspaper front pages until Wednesday, the day chosen for the invasion. Quote, if only we had an appeal for aid or military intervention, sighed Goebbels. That would make it all so simple, end quote. They stayed up far into the night talking over their next steps. Ribbentrop warned Hitler that there was bound to be a conflict with Britain eventually. Quote, the Führer, noted Goebbels, who played no part in the sometimes heated argument, is preparing for it but does not consider it inevitable, end quote. The Czech president, Emil Hácha, appointed Dr. Karel Sidor to replace Tiso in Slovakia. Hitler sent his agent Kepler to its capital, Bratislava. Kepler salvaged Tiso and brought him back to Berlin on March 13th. Without beating around the bush, Hitler told Tiso to proclaim Slovakia's independence of Prague and to do it now. Quote, over to the Führer in the evening, wrote Goebbels. He has received Tiso. Explain to him that Slovakia's historic hour has come. If they don't act, they'll be swallowed up by Hungary. He is to think it over and go back to Bratislava. No revolution. It must all be constitutional and above board. Not that we expect very much from him. But that doesn't matter now. The Führer goes over his plan once more. Within 5 days, the whole operation will be over. On the first day, we'll already be in Prague. Our planes within 2 hours, in fact. I think we'll pull it off without significant bloodshed. And then the Führer intends to take a lengthy political breather. Amen. I can't believe it. It's too good to be true. End quote. Hitler ordered the Wehrmacht to stand by to invade at 6 a.m. on the 15th. The OKW drafted an ultimatum to present to the Czechs. At noon on March 14th, Keitel reported to Hitler that the Wehrmacht was poised on the Czech frontier. Hitler debated with Goebbels the new statute establishing, quote, Bohemia and Moravia, unquote. The old name Czechoslovakia was to vanish forthwith. Goebbels, in turn, instructed his staff to bone up on Germany's historic claim to these provinces, noting, quote, we shall speak of Bohemia and Moravia as ancient German territories, end quote. To stifle foreign criticism, Hitler informed Prague that it would be to their, quote-unquote, great advantage if Dr. Hatze, despite his age and infirmity, would travel to Berlin. At 2:15 p.m., the German legation in Prague confirmed that Hatze would come to Berlin that evening, but by train. His heart would not stand the strain of flying. Hitler confidently ordered the army to invade at 6 a.m. and instructed Keitel to return to the chancellery at 9 p.m. Colonel Edward Wagner voiced the relish of all the general staff in a private letter that evening. Quote, I don't think that much will happen, and the foreign powers have expressed themselves disinterested. End of Czechoslovakia, and they have been asking for it. End quote. Hitler ordered full military honors for the Czech president's arrival. Hatzsch's daughter was accompanying him as a nurse. Hitler sent an adjutant to fill her room at the Adlon Hotel with yellow roses and placed a note there in his own handwriting. Under cover of darkness, the first German armed units crossed quietly into Czechoslovakia. The SS Liebstandarte had instructions to infiltrate Moravia and Austria before the rapacious Poles could lay hands on the modern steel mills at Witkowitz. After dinner that evening, March 14, 1939, Hitler retired to the music room to watch the latest movie, Ein Hoffnungsloser Fall, a hopeless case. Shortly, Ribbentrop reported that Hatzsch's train had arrived. Hitler examined his fingernails and remarked that the old fellow should be allowed to rest an hour or two. It was not until about 11 p.m. that Meisner ushered in the diminutive Czech president. Quote, the Führer has them wait until midnight, observed Goebbels, slowly and surely wearing them out. That's what they did with us at Versailles. The tried and tested methods of political tactics. End quote. Hitler ordered everybody out except Ribbentrop and Huell, who took a written note of their discussion. In a voice trembling with emotion, Hatzsch delivered a long-winded speech on his career as a lawyer in the Viennese civil service. He had read of and admired Hitler's ideas, he said, and he was sure that Czechoslovakia would be safe in the Führer's hands. As the monologue continued, Hitler grew uneasy. Quote, the more Hatzsche rambled on about how hard-working and conscientious the Czechs were, he would recall in May 1942, the more I felt I was sitting on red-hot coals, knowing that the invasion order had already been issued. End quote. Hitler told him that at 6 a.m. the Wehrmacht would invade Bohemia and Moravia, but the country's autonomy was assured. If Hatzsche would sign on the dotted line, there would be no bloodshed. Quote, I'm almost ashamed to admit that we have one division standing by for each Czech battalion. End quote. Twice Keitel came in to interrupt him. Twice Hitler nodded curtly. The play-acting had effect. Hatzsche and his foreign minister retired to another room to consult Prague by telephone. The line was poor. The old man had to shout, and toward 3 a.m. he suffered a heart failure. It took an injection from Hitler's personal physician, Professor Morell, to revive him. The minutes were ticking past. Hitler reminded Hatzsche of the military situation. The Wehrmacht was already moving up. Goering, who had arrived hurriedly that evening from his vacation in San Remo, interjected that at daybreak his Luftwaffe would appear over the streets of Prague. Finally, Hatzsche caved in. The main agreement was signed shortly before 4 a.m. In a second document, Hatcha agreed to surrender all Czech aircraft and weapons immediately to the Germans. But there were still problems. Hitler demanded that Tchaikovsky must countersign. Hatcha obstinately refused. The Führer would later recall having thought to himself, quote, "Look out, this is a lawyer you have facing you. Perhaps there's some law in Czechoslovakia that makes an agreement like this valid only if it is countersigned by the minister concerned." End quote. Hitler's guests left his study by one route, while Father Tiso, the Slovak prime minister, was ushered in by another and informed of the result. After that, Hitler must have sent for Wilhelm Kepler. Kepler wrote a few hours later to Himmler, quote, "When we were together with the Führer last night after the agreement had been signed, the Führer paid his particular respects to the men who risked their lives in highly dangerous missions at the front. Whereupon Ribbentrop declared that the whole job had been magnificently performed by the SS alone." End quote. For a few moments, Hitler was alone. He turned, opened the invisible door behind his monolithic desk, and walked into the tiny office where his secretaries, Krista Schroeder and Garda Daranowski, had been waiting for the all-night conference to end. His eyes sparkled, and he laughed out loud. Quote, "Well, children, now put one here and one here," end quote, he said, and shyly tapped his cheeks. Quote, "One peck each," end quote. The startled secretaries complied. Quote, "This is the most wonderful day of my life," Hitler explained. "I have now accomplished what others strove in vain for centuries to achieve. Bohemia and Moravia are back in the Reich. I will go down in history as the greatest German of all time," end quote. As his invasion of Czechoslovakia began at 8.02 a.m., Hitler's special train pulled out of Anhalt station. Hatcha and his party were still sound asleep at the Adlon. Lieutenant Colonel Kurt Zietzler of Keitel's staff kept Hitler briefed on the army's progress. By 9 a.m., the German army was in the streets of Prague. There was no bloodshed. One road bridge was barred by Czech patriots singing the national anthem. The German company commander tactfully halted his column until the anthem ended and ordered the present arms. At 2.03 p.m., Hitler's train reached the little Bohemian frontier station of Lepa, where Panzer Corps commander General Erich Hoppner awaited him with Colonel Erwin Rommel, who was to command the Führer HQ. To the consternation of Himmler and the security staff, Hitler decided to drive right on to Prague. At 4 p.m., the frontier barrier was raised for him to cross into Czechoslovakia, and in a snowstorm, his convoy headed on to the capital. He stood in his open car saluting as he passed his regiments. It was dusk when he arrived in Prague. At first, nobody knew where Hatcha's official residence, the Hradčany Castle, was. Hitler's drivers finally entered it through a gate in the rear. A palace flunky was found to guide them to a wing where these unexpected visitors might sleep, but Hitler did not rest yet. He began dictating a law establishing a German, quote-unquote, protectorate over Bohemia and Moravia. At 2 a.m, a cold buffet arrived, provided by the local German center. There was Pilsen beer. Hitler was prevailed upon to sample a small glass, but he grimaced, did not finish it, and went to bed. The first that the citizens of Prague knew of his presence in their midst was next morning, when they espied his personal swastika stand, a standard beating from a flagpole atop the snow-bedecked palace roofs. The initial reaction from London was that this was an affair that need not concern them. The British public, however, refused to swallow Hitler's quote-unquote annexation of Bohemia and Moravia, and Chamberlain was obliged to deliver a strongly worded speech in Birmingham, demanding, quote, "Is this in fact a step in the direction of an attempt to dominate the world by force?" End quote. About a week later, however, Chamberlain reassured Hitler through a third party that he quite sympathized with Germany's move, even though he was unable to say so in public, as he was being exposed to intemperate attacks by the Churchill clique. The benefits of this new conquest well outweighed the Western powers' opprobrium. Control of Prague brought to Hitler the gold reserves needed to overcome the Reich's huge budget deficit. airfields to threaten Poland and Russia, and a front line shorter by 1,000 miles to defend. It furnished to him Czech tanks, artillery, and aircraft. Moreover, it put Romania and Yugoslavia in his thrall, because their armed forces were largely equipped by the Škoda arms factory at Pilsen. Hitler's officers marveled at his fresh accomplishment, and many of the weaker fry, who in harder times would sidle over to the quote-unquote resistance movement, in March 1939 wrote admiring words in their private diaries and letters to their friends. Surprisingly, the protectorate brought blessings for the Czechs as well. Their economy was stabilized and unemployment vanished. Their menfolk were not called upon to bear arms in Hitler's coalition. Their armed forces were dissolved, and their officers were given state pensions on Hitler's orders to purchase their dependence and complicity. The industrious Czechs accepted rich contracts from the Reich and learned eventually to cherish the Pax Teutonica enforced by Reinhard Heydrich in 1941. It was the peace of the graveyard, but Heydrich won the affection of the Czech workers to such an extent, for instance, by introducing the first ever Bismarckian social security and pension schemes, that 30,000 Czechs thronged into Wenceslas Square in Prague to demonstrate against his murder in 1942. The Czechs had not been required to sell their souls, and this was what Hitler had promised Hatzia in Berlin. Hatzia himself never felt any grievance. He inquired of Morel about the prescription he had been injected with, and thereafter obtained a regular supply from Morel's pharmacy. He would die forgotten in an Allied prison in 1945. Tiso and Tuka were both hanged. On March 16, 1939, Hitler's propaganda minister issued another confidential edict to Nazi editors. Quote, "The use of the term Grossdeutsches Reich is not desired. This term is reserved for later eventualities." End quote. The next objects on Hitler's list of acquisitions were, of course, Memel, Danzig, and the Polish Corridor. Late on March 21st, when Dr. Goebbels escorted Hitler to the theater to camouflage what was going on, Ribbentrop issued a crude ultimatum to Lithuania to hand back Memel. The Lithuanian foreign minister, Josas Urbšas, was hurriedly summoned to Berlin, and he signed the necessary papers after Ribbentrop and Wiesacker had tightened the screw. Ribbentrop simultaneously summoned the Polish ambassador, Lipski, and restated the offer of October concerning Danzig. He even hinted that Slovakia might be the subject of later discussions with Poland after the Danzig issue had been settled. While still awaiting Lithuania's response, Hitler meanwhile discussed with Goebbels the moves that would follow the return of Danzig. First, he would seek a respite to restore public confidence, and then he would raise the question of Germany's erstwhile colonies. Quote, "Always the old 1-2," unquote, noted Goebbels admiringly. Lipski betook himself to Warsaw to obtain a reply. Quote, "He's going to try out a little pressure on the Poles," wrote Goebbels, and end quote. After talking with Hitler on March 24th. Quote, "And he hopes they'll respond to that, but we're going to have to swallow the bitter pill and guarantee Poland's other frontiers. It will all be decided very soon." End quote. On the 25th, Hitler privately reassured General von Brauchitsch that he did not want to resort to force against Poland. Brauchitsch's aide-de-camp noted Hitler as saying, quote, "The possibility of taking Danzig by military action will only be examined if Lipski gives us to understand that the Polish government will be unable to explain to its own public any voluntary surrender of Danzig, but that a fate accompli by us would help them to a solution." End quote. It is evident that Hitler really did expect such an under-the-counter deal. On March 27th, Admiral Raeder initialed a draft plan for Hitler to embark on the cruiser Deutschland and appear off Danzig with virtually the entire battle fleet. Hitler would go ashore by torpedo boat and proceed in triumph to the city center. So much for planning. His actual entry into Danzig 6 months later looked very different. Lithuania proved more accommodating over Memel. the ancient Teutonic city had been annexed by Lithuania after the Great War. Hitler anchored off Memel aboard Deutschland early on March 23rd, symbolically toured the city with Rommel as HQ commandant and Milch in lieu of Goering, who had returned to San Remo, and then went back to Berlin. Quote, "What a week that was," unquote, recorded Goebbels. The Poles reacted to this new Hitler triumph truculently by partially mobilizing, as Canaris reported on March 25th. When Hitler left Berlin that evening, he explained, according to Brauchitsch, quote, "I don't want to be around when Lipsky gets back. Ribbentrop is to deal with them initially." Lipsky duly returned from Warsaw by the 26th. Oh, that was end quote. Lipsky duly returned from Warsaw by the 26th with a brusque rejection of the German demand for Danzig, to which he added the verbal warning, that if Hitler persisted, it would mean war. Quote, "The Pollocks," recorded an angry Dr. Goebbels, "will always be our natural enemies. However keen in the past they may have been, out of pure self-interest, to do us the odd favor," end quote. On March 27th, Wiesacker summarized in his diary, quote, "It will no longer be possible to solve the Danzig problem, now that we have used up foreign political goodwill over Prague and Memel. A German-Polish conflict now would trigger an avalanche against us. For the time being, the only way we can deal with the Poles' insolent attitude and their high-handed rebuff to the offer we have made to them is by breaking the Polish spirit." End quote. Strolling on the Obersalzberg mountainside, Hitler pondered his next move. Just as here in 1938 he had wrestled with Green, on March 25th he had assured Brauchitsch that he would not tackle the Polish, as distinct from the Danzig problem, yet. There would first have to be particularly favorable political conditions. Quote, I would then knock Poland so flat that, politically speaking, we wouldn't have to take any account of her for many decades to come. End quote. The Reich would thereby regain its 1914 eastern frontier, from East Prussia to eastern Silesia. Meanwhile, Stalin had delivered a stinging rebuke to the Western democracies at a Moscow Congress. Hitler studied the newsreel films and pronounced that Stalin looked quite, quote-unquote, congenial. Late on March 30th, he returned to Berlin. In Berlin, a rude shock awaited him. The next morning, news arrived from London that Neville Chamberlain was about to announce in Parliament that, quote, "In the event of any action which clearly threatened Polish independence and which the Polish government accordingly considered it vital to resist, His Majesty's government would feel themselves bound at once to lend the Polish government all support in their power." End quote. This was the first of a sheaf of ill-considered guarantees to be uttered by the British. Its effect was not what Chamberlain had hoped for. At 12:45 p.m., Hitler sent for Keitel. Whatever the origins of England's guarantee, by the time Hitler left Berlin, that is by 8:47 p.m., on March 31st, he had given the OKW orders to make all due preparations for war with Poland, under the code name White. At Wilhelmshaven, the next morning, he launched a second 35,000-ton battleship, the Tirpitz. It is to be emphasized that he had still not issued any actual instruction for war. This new OKW directive on White, issued on April 3rd, merely outlined a political situation which might make an attack on Poland necessary on or after September 1st. Meanwhile, the OKW ruled. Friction with Poland was to be avoided, a difficult injunction since the Poles had certainly not behaved kindly toward their own ethnic German minority. During April and again in May 1939, explicit directives went out to every Nazi editor not to draw comparisons between what was happening in Poland and what had happened in 1938 in Czechoslovakia. Hitler probably hoped that, quote-unquote, wetting the blade alone would force the Poles to think again. As General Walter von Reichenau had admiringly commented on October 3, 1938, quote, "If the Führer was a poker player, he'd win thousands of Reichsmarks every night," end quote. In April 1939, this poker image also came to Baron von Wiesacker's mind. The diplomat believed that Hitler was playing a game for high stakes, but would know how to pick up the winnings at just the right moment and quit. In mid-April, he forecast privately, quote, a creeping crisis but short of war. Every man must do his duty, end quote. Curiously, Hitler had not consulted Goering over White. The field marshal did not return from his Italian Riviera leave until 6 p.m. On April 18th, he then appeared at Hitler's dinner table looking bronzed and fit. Hitler told him of his determination to force a settlement over Danzig. Goering was taken aback, quote, what am I supposed to understand by that, unquote. The Führer replied that if all else failed to regain Danzig, he was going to use force. Goering warned that world opinion would not stand for it. Hitler calmed him down, saying he had handled the other situations skillfully in the past, and Poland would be no exception. At about the same time, Goering's aide, the Luftwaffe General Karl Bodenschatz, dropped a broad hint to the Polish military attaché that if Hitler believed that Germany was being encircled, then he would make an alliance with the devil himself. Quote, and you and I are well aware of who that devil is, unquote, threatened Bodenschatz in a scarcely veiled reference to the Soviet Union. Initially, Hitler used his approach to the Kremlin only as diplomatic leverage against Poland, but there was no doubting Stalin's interest. One of Ribbentrop's Berlin officials, Rudolf Leikas, reported on April 1st that the Soviet war minister, General K.E. Voroshilov, had suggested in a conversation with the wife of the German ambassador that Hitler and Stalin revise their attitudes towards each other. Shortly, Ribbentrop learned from the same official that a high Soviet embassy official had remarked that Germany and the Soviet Union could pursue a great policy, quote-unquote, side by side. Hitler still hesitated to inch out further onto this thin ice, and Ribbentrop instructed his men not to pursue this dialogue. At the end of April, however, Hitler omitted from yet another major speech the usual hostile references to the Soviet regime. Stalin responded on May 3rd by dismissing Maxim Litvinov, the Jewish foreign minister, who would have been an obvious obstacle to any settlement with Nazi Germany. At this, Hitler really sat up and took notice. He ordered key Moscow embassy officials back to Germany to report to him. The outcome of these consultations was an instruction to the German ambassador, Count Werner von der Schulenburg, to throw out cautious feelers to Vyacheslav Molotov, the new foreign minister, as to a possible rapprochement and the resumption of trade negotiations. On the 5th, Goebbels confidently instructed all Nazi editors that there were to be no diatribes against Bolshevism or the Soviet Union, quote, until further notice, unquote. On the following day, Karl Bodenschatz again dropped a curious hint, this time to the French air attaché, Paul Stalin. Quote, you'll soon find out, unquote, the Luftwaffe general said, quote, that something is afoot in the East.